the moon, Titan, you know, from Saturn, that they, that cloud-covered moon, they wanted to look below that cloud cover and see what was there. And they were desperate to do that. So they sold off going to Uranus and Neptune with Voyager. Voyager 1 to do that, to get the pictures and the information that they wanted from the moon Titan. That's why, you know, you would think you had the two spacecraft, but send them both to those planets, but only Voyager 2 went to Uranus and Neptune. The other one didn't. So, interesting fact to deal with the Voyager spacecraft. So how valuable was it? They didn't get enough information. It's so cloud-covered.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They landed on the moon Titan many years ago. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to the planets that, when it comes to the spacecraft, I think Kepler was one of them, Cassini was another. One of them went in orbit around Jupiter, one of them went in orbit around Saturn. And, tremendous amount of fuel had to be burned in reverse to get into the vicinity of Jupiter or Saturn, which ordinarily would have been a flyby and a gravity assist of some kind. And you've got to cancel all that gravity assist by, I think it was something like an 8-minute burn, if I remember correctly, to get in orbit around Jupiter. I think it was Kepler that did it. And so a tremendous amount of fuel is required on a spacecraft that started off very heavy, in order to be able to go down, slow down enough when you get into the vicinity of that planet to get captured by the planet to go into orbit around the planet. And I'm reasonably sure they didn't use any kind of atmospheric drag as a slowdown procedure because you don't want to do too close to Jupiter. It's got some ridiculously strong... The equivalent of a Van Allen belt on Jupiter, I think, is enough to wipe out almost any spacecraft you got. So, although I'm trying to remember which science fiction movie. Let me drop it. Yeah, it was the Stanley Kubrick movie. I think it was
2010.
That's the one. So I think it was the 2010 movie in which they used this Baryut thing to use the atmospheric drag of Jupiter to get into orbit around Jupiter. A nice science fiction, but I think if you really did that, I think there would be very little human survivability because of the radiation belt around Jupiter. That's my impression. That sound about right, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, they call that aerobraking. They did that with reconnaissance, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, I think. Probably did it with Odyssey, Mars Odyssey as well. You know, they get in low enough to just pick up a little atmosphere. It just slows them down, and they do this over and over again. It takes many, many months to slow them down. But it saves on all the fuel that you would have had to bring with you to use as a retro rocket system. Yeah, you're thinking about Galileo. A lot of fuel, but I think it was 40 minutes. I mean, the rocket just kept firing. I don't know. I'd have to check anywhere between, I think, 25 and 40 minutes or something for the burn going around Jupiter. And same with Saturn, with Cassini. Very long burn. I mean, not minutes, but tens of minutes, you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes, some ridiculous amount of time. And so that's how much fuel they had to do that. They were your main orbital missions. And we haven't had an orbital mission for Jupiter since then. I mean, they put Galileo up there for, a three-year mission or something. It stayed for three extended missions for 10 years and gave us plenty of information back. They deorbited that and crashed it into Jupiter. They didn't want it to accidentally land on any one of the Galilean moons or any one of the other moons to contaminate it. These things were not steam sprayed, you might say.
Repeater, time out.
These spacecraft, Galileo and Cassini, weren't decontaminated. They didn't want to land on any kind of a moon, so they crashed into Jupiter. And the same thing will probably happen eventually with Cassini, but that's still doing a lot of good work out there in the orbit of Saturn. So here's Juno on the way, and that's actually going to be in a polar orbit. It's a lot different than the Galilean mission. Juno, no, I don't think Juno's going to do aerobraking. I don't believe that one's going to do aerobraking. That would just be retro rockets, too. And the 2010 movie, yeah, that was great. Great seeing that thing slow it, trying to slow itself down. Back to you, Dick.
I've forgotten the name of the two spacecraft that preceded Voyager, which you said are now no longer functioning. Are they no longer functioning because they were turned off? Did they run out of radioactive fuel? Was something on board running out of life? The two spacecraft that preceded Voyager, they're no longer functioning for what reason, Paul? And why can't I think of their name? K2LIW?
Pioneer 10 and 11. There were a bunch of Pioneer missions, but they were the ones that went out to Jupiter and all. Quick flyby of Saturn. One of them, they eventually lost lock with Earth. The other one, I think they just shut it down. I don't know what exactly happened with that. I don't think it just broke. I think they just shut it down. It ceased to exist. They were using the Voyager spacecraft. They were giving them a lot more information, I guess. But I think one just did not have, couldn't point its antenna back to it or Earth probably anymore. And maybe the other one, they might have just stopped their transmitting to it. Don't know for sure about the second one. They were both Pioneer missions.
In the case of Voyager, that dish has something in the vicinity of 46 decibels of gain, and it's got something like 8/10 of a degree of beamwidth at 8.5 gigs. So therefore, you want to aim it to the nearest couple of tenths of 1 degree in azimuth and elevation when you aim that dish back toward Earth with its 46 dB of gain. 46 dB is a 40,000-to-1 ratio. Each watt you put into it with 46 dB of gain looks like 40,000 watts coming out of the dish because it's aiming the signal like a pencil beam. And the good news is that pencil beam can really give you a lot more steam aiming that signal back toward Earth. But boy, you better be accurate. You aim it 1 degree wrong in azimuth and or elevation, and that beautiful pencil beam misses the Earth entirely, and you will never talk to that thing again. So I guess you're saying the Pioneer could have easily lost that positional accuracy. You and I have had this discussion. Let me drop. We've had this discussion once before that the inertial wheels, the gyroscopes, so to speak, that are on Voyager, here they are 37 years later, still cranking, still keeping that aiming of that antenna to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree in aiming that dish toward Earth 37 years later. And some of that is locking on the sun, probably locking on the Earth, locking on... It's using various celestial objects as a reference for doing that aiming. Maybe not all of it's the inertial wheels. Wait a minute now. The locking on those celestial objects, Sirius and sun and whatever, bright stars, tells it where it should aim, but it still has to physically move that dish into that direction. And the reaction control jets and the inertial wheels have to do that. and they have kept doing it accurately for 37 years. Whatever brand name of that inertial wheel is, we got to keep buying that brand name, Paul. Jeffy West 2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, spin them up that much. What happens is it keeps going, and as long as they've got a lock on it, as long as it sees this sun, it does have a sun sensor. It looks right through the power dish. They have a hole in the antenna, so it can look right through it. The star tracker, which is looking at one of the stars, because of the letter C, I forget the name of that one, but it's got that one in its sight. All these things help it keep its position in space. But, you know, if they need to change something, that's what they did a couple of times. They wanted to change the direction of the plasma detector, the wave detector, and they moved the whole spacecraft. And they told them, move it, and the whole thing moved. The antenna pointed completely away from us. It took its readings, recorded on the 8-track tape, had it programmed to look for the star tracking system again, and turned itself backwards. The antenna came back into line, and they continued talking to the spacecraft that way. So I think that's an amazing feat. They turned the thing 90 degrees off from where it was located to get an idea of where the plasma was coming from, the ions were coming from, and then turn back and send the information back. I mean, to do this, over 3 times the distance of Pluto, it's an amazing feat. It really is.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think you said, Paul, it's more amazing than doing what? Why, I missed that sentence. Go ahead.
It's almost amazing. It's almost more amazing than putting a man on the moon to be able to operate and do what we're talking about here, Dick.
And if you think about it, just like you said, it's an extremely dangerous maneuver. You're giving it a bunch of commands to take this dish that's being aimed to the nearest tenth of a degree, and you're telling it steer 90 degrees, which is 900 times further away in aiming accuracy, make a measurement of the solar wind or the galactic wind, and then come back accurately in the right azimuth and the right elevation, 900 units away in as an elevation, to aim again to the nearest tenth of a degree toward Earth. Before you give a command like that to Voyager, you gotta be triple damn sure the command got properly received. Let me drop. Because if in following that command, something goes wrong, and it ends up aiming the dish in some other direction, that beautiful piece of hardware, you will never talk to it again. It just became a piece of space junk as far as you're concerned. I'm almost positive what NASA does is they very carefully write a program telling it what to do. And a whole bunch of people check the program and recheck it to make sure there's no glitches in the program. Then you tell Voyager, I'm going to upload a program to you. You're going to record it on your 8-track tape or whatever your recording medium is. Do not do it. Record the program. Then feed it back to me. Tell me what you heard. So that Voyager reads what it heard back down. And then you study the daylights out of that and say, yep, every one of those bits is correct. And once you make sure it heard the message correctly, because every time you send a digital message over 12 billion miles, no matter what the hell you do, there's a certain bit error rate that's going to be there. And if one of those critical bits that you want to be a 1 got received by a Voyager as a 0, and it steers it off to some other crazy angle to hell it gone, it's game over. You'll never talk to it again. So you set send the message back down. Tell me what you heard. You study the daylights out of the downlink message and say, yeah, you got it right. Now go do it. I am almost positive they better do that. Because if they don't, you see the danger they're getting into here, Paul. WS2N, bunch of speculations on my part. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah. I know they have a system on all these spacecraft, Voyages and the Ulysses and anything that's gone way out there. In fact, it's all spacecraft, I would think. If it doesn't hear from NASA after a certain period of time, I mean, even Curiosity, all the robotic missions on Mars, if it doesn't hear from you, you know, it'll go into either a safe mode, stay there for a while, and then after a certain amount of time goes by, it'll do a self-diagnostic, make sure everything's okay, and if everything's okay, it'll start looking for the different star locations, and then it will reorient itself and point itself back to Earth, or in Curiosity's case, it would recommunicate with with Earth. And Juno just had that problem when it went past Earth, 300 miles above the surface. After 2.5 years in orbit, zooming past Earth for that gravitational assist, right after it passed, it went into a safe mode. But it didn't change anything. It's still on the way to Jupiter, and after a day or two, it came back to life. Probably had a program on board to set itself up and continue on. So they do have that safety built into all these spacecraft.
When it comes to bit error rate of a radio signal, where occasionally you're going to get a burst of noise, a burst of cosmic rays, a glitch in one of your circuits, literally a bug of some kind, how it really became obvious to me, where it wasn't even a radio circuit. This is a hardwired circuit. This was 1972. This was one of the main countdown circuits that was built into the AIL spectrum analyzer that I was working on at the time. This was a circuit that was capable of counting. This is a bunch of JK flip-flops hooked together in cascade. It's capable of counting to 16. But because of the operations we were having this counter do, we only wanted it to go to either 12 or 13, as I remember. So we had set up the feedback in such a way that it would count to 13, and then the 13th count would reset it back to 0, and it would count again up to 13. So it was capable of going to 16, and we were resetting it at 13. And so that circuit was working like a charm, and all of a sudden we're building a production run of these spectrum analyzers. Let me drop. And you look at a whole bunch of them sitting on a desk, and after a couple of hours of running, every fourth one, the screen would lock up. And boy, it took us a long time to figure out what's going on. Sometimes the screen would lock up in half an hour. Sometimes it would take hours. Sometimes it would take 8 hours, and sometimes it would take 2 days. But if you waited long enough, the screen would eventually lock up. We discovered that the way we had set up these JK flip-flops to go to 13, reset itself, and go back to 0, occasionally it didn't get the reset, or it got some kind of a glitch during the 13 counts, and it went to count number 14 or 15. It went to a mode where it hung up and it could no longer count. And we couldn't figure out how in the world the glitch would happen to do that, but it was happening. And because of the way the circuit was wired, we didn't want to rebuild that whole damn circuit. The solution was to have a bunch of tap points on those JK flip-flops that were all going into an AND gate that would recognize the signature of the hang-up mode. We literally built another parallel circuit to sense the hang-up, and then it would give a master reset to that whole circuit when it saw the hang-up mode. Let me drop. And that cured it. So on hardwired circuits, very reliable mil-spec JK flip-flops, how in the world could it get a burst of noise when it's hardwired and good clean power supplies, nice layout for printed circuit board, good shielding? How in the world could it get a glitch? Cosmic ray or whatever, but the high voltage circuit, I don't know. It happened. So every transmission that you send digitally has a bit error rate. Every time the DNA in your cells does mitosis and reproduces another cell, there is a bit error rate to that DNA. And that bit error rate creates evolution. Let me drop. And so modern day digital programming packets have something called a cyclic redundancy code that can detect an error, and by Viterbi techniques, forward error correcting, you can do a certain amount of error tolerance correcting. That the system detects the error and corrects the error. There's enough built-in extra information as to how to correct the error when the error is there, as long as there aren't too many simultaneous errors. Sort of what's going on with your DNA. There's a built-in error correcting code to your DNA. What you and I call cancer is when the number of errors in that reproduction process gets so large that the error correcting code no longer can correct, and the cell flips over to become a cancer. There are people who have that theory, and there's quite a bit of confirmation that that could be part of what's going on. So no matter what you do, no matter how you send a signal on hardwire, in a fiber, through the air, radio, whatever, a digital signal of a whole lot of bits is going to have a bit error rate. And so there's got to be safe modes and other ways of detecting the error and saying, okay, I'm going to hang up the separate monitoring circuit looks for the error and does something called safe mode when it sees it. One other thing I was going to mention, Paul, let me drop it. When each of those spacecraft went into orbit at Jupiter or Saturn, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to pick numbers out of the air. You probably were flying a spacecraft at something like 30,000 miles an hour as it approached Jupiter or as it approached Saturn. And because of the gravity assist phenomena, by the time it got close to Jupiter, that 30,000 miles an hour probably went to 60,000 miles an hour. It was ready to do a gravity assist and swing you by Jupiter and fly you out of the Jupiter vicinity at a much higher velocity. In order to get into orbit around Jupiter, you had to make a burn to kill your original 30,000 and to kill the original and to kill the additional 30,000 that Jupiter's gravity field gave you because it was about to give you a slingshot assist as you passed by that planet. So part of the reason why that burn was so big and so long is you're killing at least two sources of energy, if you know what I mean, when you're doing that burn to get into orbit. That's what I think was taking place. I wonder if it was ever explained that way, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
I think Galileo, which went around Jupiter, if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to go back and check, but I'm pretty sure you were up to 100,000 miles per hour before the rocket started firing to slow it down. And I think Cassini was probably close to it with Saturn. Saturn's not as massive. Probably had 80,000, 90,000 maybe with that too. I'd have to check. I know it was way up there, big numbers like that.
And so therefore it went into something like maybe it was a 40-minute burn, 30-minute burn, some huge amount of burn. And think about that burn. Not only is that burn a long time, not only is there going to be enough fuel on board, not only does that rocket engine have to hang in there for that burn, but all of that burn has got to be in the right direction. You're doing spacecraft precise orientation to the nearest small fraction of 1 degree during that whole 40-minute burn. You make that burn that you think is a deceleration burn, and something goes wrong and you aim that rocket slightly in the wrong direction. Guarantee you're going to be unhappy. What was you, Paul? K2LAW.
I concur. I'm always amazed when you look at some of these diagrams, new horizon going out to Pluto. I mean, you know, you've got all the planets on the ecliptic, and here's this Pluto, I forget how many degrees, tilted 13 degrees, or whatever it is, tilted to the ecliptic. By the time it gets there, on after this 10-year run, in 2015, Pluto happens to be crossing at the ecliptic. Pluto, you know, crosses the ecliptic twice during each one of its orbits, and you know, each orbit is about a couple hundred years or something. But here is this timing of this Pluto crossing the ecliptic. You see, it's like an X where you know, X marks the spot between the ecliptic and, orbit and the Pluto orbit. And here comes New Horizon and meeting it exactly at the same spot. Not even going into orbit, just passing it is incredible. I know they got computers and all, but somebody had to think this all up. Somebody's losing a lot of sleep over these these diagrams that they created. There.
What's your guess that's on the drawing board right now for future spacecraft, Paul? What's the most interesting ones that you have been hearing about that are on the drawing board, and hopefully they'll become a successful project, and hopefully they will get congressional funding? What have we got to look forward to other than New Horizons? Kepler, I'm very unhappy about the fact that it was so busily detecting brand new exosolar planets, but unfortunately its alignment system failed. Now, that had to be kept to the nearest couple of minutes of arc aimed at all of those 100,000 stars that it was studying. And all of those 100,000 stars, let me grab them. This telescope was aimed at a real small chunk of sky, a real high magnification image of all of that chunk of sky, went through this perforated disk with a whole bunch of holes where each individual star had to go through the right hole in the aperture disk in order to go down to a detector so that you could carefully see any blinking of one of those stars because a planet moved in front of the star in its orbit. And so this Kepler had to be very precisely aimed. By some means, it lost that aiming, and I'm guessing an inertial wheel, too many inertial wheels failed. And so this beautiful piece of hardware detecting thousands of exoplanets now can't aim itself correctly and can't find anything anymore, I think is sort of the final conclusion. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, about Kepler?
Yeah, from what I read, that's about right. I don't know. I mean, if they want to use it for some kind of scanning of the skies, they're going to try to use it for something. But you know, it's not going to do anything like what they had planned on. You know, terrific success, hundreds of planets that this thing found, and hundreds more that you know they've got to research everything that. Information that came back for the next couple of years, they're going to be discovering more, even so the year Kepler's not working. But future missions, well, TESS is going to replace Kepler. That's pretty good. I like that one. I try to follow them after they're funded. Sometimes they have these pie-in-the-sky missions that I don't really pay attention to until they're funded or named or for instance, the New Generation Telescope, you know, for decades was out there, and finally it was funded, and eventually it was named, and now they call it the James Webb Space Telescope, which will be in orbit in 2018. So only 5 years from now, a million miles out from away from the Earth, that's pretty exciting. But some of the ones that they talk about, I'd love to see developed, for instance, let me drop it. NASA would love to have enough funding to send a spacecraft and land on Europa. I'd like to see it too. Nuclear power source on board after it lands on this ice-covered planet, start melting its way, you know, taking a I mean, it sounds like science fiction, but they want to melt through almost a mile of ice and have a spacecraft, or maybe a correction, really like a, not a spacecraft, but a submarine, follow this thing all the way down into the ice, and especially get into the water that they think is below Europa, and start swimming around and looking for stuff. I mean, that they have a lot of pie-in-the-sky ideas, but I mean, that's what they said about the space telescope, the Webb, James Webb Space Telescope. And sure enough, that thing got funded. Let me drop it.
Don't forget, Dick, I think Wesley had a question.
And there's a few more, but we'll follow them. Naturally, the manned space program, I think, is going to be pretty exciting in the corporate world. SpaceX, orbital science, Sierra Nevada with their dream craft. Got Boeing building the CST-100, which is going to carry up to 7 astronauts to the International Space Station, and eventually up to the Bigelow Space Station, yet to be built. These missions are all something to look forward to. Back to that, yeah, I know, we don't want to forget about Wesley. Back to you, Dick.
Now, if we had some time, I'd like to know some more about what TESS is going to do that's better than Kepler. But let's flip over to Wesley's question. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Well, you want to discuss the stuff, go ahead. I have a question and I have a subject to discuss. I believe an interesting one, but it's up to you.
Well, it's going to be years before TESS is launched, so let's go to your question. I can wait. You got it, Wes.
Okay. There was an interesting video showing the mass acceleration, and that leads in the effect of it to the particle acceleration, betatrons, synchrotrons, LIGNAC accelerators. It's like a simple way for the people to understand how the cyclotron works, or LIGNAC, or how the big hadron collider works. And the question is right with it was actually not from me, it was from John, because John said, what if that acceleration that doesn't use any energy besides the magnetic energy that is inside of the magnet, you just give a very, very slow, like a snail, initial energy, like just... What about if you just circle it? And I believe that I found extremely interesting answer for it. But John would explain you what that video was. It was a very short video, but very nice catching guy. John?
KC2WQB. Yeah, Dick, I'm sure you got the video. I think he sent it to you. It's a ball bearing accelerator. He has like 5 magnets set up on an aluminum rod, and two of these ball bearings on each magnet, and at the end there are 2 ball bearings on that magnet, and when he just pushes very slightly with his finger and bumps into the first ball bearing, say to the right, all the bearings start to click, move forward, the magnet accelerates it, it'll click to the second one, accelerates it more and more. I don't know if you saw the video, but I was just saying that if this thing is really working the way it's working, if we used electric magnets and timed them, we would be able to just set the thing to go by itself. But I just wanted to know if you had taken a look at it.
I may have seen portions of it. I think that was either 1 or 2 weeks ago. But let me zoom back here for a minute and see. I'm going to ask you a question, John, see if I'm understanding or misunderstanding it. When you take those particles that are being accelerated by the biggest accelerator I know of, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, in Switzerland and France, it's under the borderline of both countries, the total amount of energy you put into those particles is huge. If you have to dump that beam, we're talking about a lot of megajoules of energy that's capable of burning holes in a great big chunk of carbon dummy load, if you know what I mean. So to accelerate particles to a significant velocity is a much, much larger, let me drop it, a much, much larger version of what you're doing when you accelerate your daughter swinging on a swing, or you're putting energy into a flywheel, any of these cyclic-like things where you put a small amount of energy on each individual cycle or each individual turn, and you keep doing it thousands of times, you eventually build up a whole lot of energy as long as you're smart enough to set it up in such a way that there's no loss in between those cycles. If you can make the loss very small, and even though the energy you're putting in is not very much, as long as it's greater in rate than the loss, then the thing you're putting energy into is going to build up. In the case of the Large Hadron Collider, you've got a whole series of larger and larger and larger accelerators until you get up to the great big LHC, because each accelerator is capable of taking particles from one particular velocity and bringing them up to a higher velocity, but you can't start off at zero on these great big circular rings because, let me drop, in order to make those particles move into your particular circle of your particular diameter, you need a particular amount of magnetic deflection. So you're literally tuning those magnets continuously as you accelerate those particles. And as such, you don't start off at zero velocity and zero magnetic field. And the maximum magnetic field you can go up to is also predetermined. So there's a certain amount of velocity you can give them, and you can't exceed it. So each individual accelerator has a particular energy region and a particular diameter and a particular strength of magnetic field over which it's effective. You can't get something for nothing. You may have seen an experiment where pushing your finger is giving some energy in a particular experiment on the table, but can you do it cyclically over and over again to where you're building up megajoules in that accelerator? I mean, you don't get something for nothing. There's no free lunch. Those particles that you want to really be moving at relativistic velocities, let me drop, takes a lot of energy to get there. And I don't think there's any shortcut. You may think you see a shortcut. I'm awfully skeptical. Because if those particles, by this simple process, end up moving faster, they've got more energy. Where does that energy come from?
Some magnetic field of the magnet.
Now, you can't get free energy out of a magnet.
Well, you do it in a field.
Wes, you and I have seen by now almost hundreds of movies, YouTube videos, where guys have got these strong neodymium magnets running on rotary machines, and they want you to believe the magnetic energy is so strong that it builds up continuously, and you keep getting more and more energy out of the motor because of the magnet. A fixed magnetic field out of a fixed neodymium magnet will not continuously give you energy. I mean, it's like me putting a spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter. It may be in orbit around Jupiter, and I'm now talking about 50 consecutive orbits. I'm not getting more energy on each orbit. As I fly by Jupiter once, with one slingshot flyby, I get some energy. I can't keep going back and doing that over and over again by just making a simple loop around Jupiter and getting more energy each time I make an orbit around Jupiter. You can do it once. To do it cyclically, somebody has to be cycling the strength of the magnetic field. A fixed magnetic field will not continuously give you energy. A bunch of YouTube videos make it look like that. How many people have a successful machine that's really giving them above unity? We've seen lots and lots of videos where claims are made. We've seen lots and lots of guys selling plans and whatever.
Repeater, timeout.
Lots and lots of plans, but how come nobody is using those machines? I can't believe that that many machines, that many people, that many countries, that many experiments are all being held back by that many conspiracies. Something is wrong. Over to you for a rebuttal on that one, Wes. And 2XJN, K2LIW.
Clarification, were you done with him?
Maybe you should give the clarification now, because I may be way off to one side. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, I was talking about the mechanical assembly itself that he was playing with in his video. I in no way relate that to the Large Hadron Collider. Absolutely not. Wesley is. I am not. It's just a simple mechanical machine.
Okay, Wes, you cannot continuously get energy out of a fixed magnet, even though these new neodymium magnets are super strong. And the first time you zing something by it, yes, you'll get some energy. But you can't cyclically, continuously get energy out of a fixed magnet. Even though there's a lot of YouTube videos that say that, I'm having trouble believing it, because where's all of these machines giving all of this above unity energy? Who's hiding them? Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2LIW.
The mechanical device that was presented was the one that was using the steady magnetic field of the magnets to speed up the mass. It's exactly the same concept, exactly one-to-one. Not one-to-half, one-to-one, as in a particle collider or particle accelerator. It works the same. The only thing is that in particle accelerators, they try to speed up the particles using electromagnets or using the whole tube at a certain length just to speed up the particles. But it could do that with the magnets. Now, as far as the circulation, well, we're talking about the circulation. We had, in 1940s, we had a betatron, then we had a synchrotron, then we've been dealing with the cyclotron, then we've been dealing with LIGNAC. And if you think about the circulator that we use in high frequency systems, actually, you don't pay for the energy being circulated because you have a magnet on it. You pay for the energy being sent, but not circulated. Because the steady magnetic field of the magnet does the job. So yes, there is no comparison with the speed of the particles, but there is a comparison with the mechanism. Whatever is mechanic, it applies to any mass containing particles. And there is no exemption from it. Unless you're dealing with photons. And to appear.
Okay, yeah, let me give you a couple of words on a circulator. The thing that gives isolation so that the signal flowing from the transmitter goes to the circulator, then goes to the antenna. That's from port number one to port number two. And any signal coming back from the antenna into port number two goes to port number three, which is a dummy load. Any reflection off that dummy load from port number three would go to port number one. But if you put on a good dummy load, it absorbs all the energy. So the way the circulator works is that you think the signal is going from one to two, from two to three, and from three to one. It looks like that from the outside world. Not true. What's really going on inside is something a little bit more complicated. Let me drop. The circulator is using a piece of ferrite, yttrium iron garnet-like material, a very fancy piece of magnetic material is the medium. The biasing magnetic field tunes it to a particular frequency region, like, say, for instance, 10 gigahertz, and what's going on when you properly set it up is that there is a signal going clockwise from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 3 to 1. There's also an equal magnitude signal going backwards from 1 to 3, from 3 to 2, from 2 to 1. You've got clockwise and counterclockwise equal magnitude going on simultaneously. But there's a catch. Let me drop. That biased magnetic material, that yik-like material, is almost acting like a plasma. and the plasma of the ionosphere has this crazy characteristic where it does not obey reciprocity. However a signal flows from New York to London through that ionosphere, it behaves differently for the signal that flows from London back to New York. You may get three twists in polarization, Faraday rotation, going from New York to London. You may only get 2.5 twists going from London back to New York. It doesn't obey reciprocity. The same thing with the circulator. Because of the crazy way the Yig material behaves, and because of the way the magnetic field biases it, there is a clockwise signal and a counterclockwise signal. They move at a slightly different velocity. Because the clockwise signal is moving at one speed, and the counterclockwise signal is moving at a slightly different speed, the net result is that the signal flowing from 1 to 2, going clockwise, and the signal going from 2 to 1, really is going all the way around the outside. And the clockwise signals add up in phase at number 2, and the counterclockwise signals add up out of phase at number 2, and they cancel. Therefore, simplistically, you think you've made the signal flow only from 1 to 2. You happen to be getting cancellations on the undesired report, on undesired port, because of this difference in velocity of clockwise and counterclockwise caused by the biasing magnetic field. Take away that magnet, all that magic goes away. Take away the Earth's magnetic field, and the ionosphere doesn't behave the way it does. So whenever you've got a plasma-like material and a biasing magnetic field, you get differences in...
Repeater, timeout.
I think if I did a careful timing experiment on the signal flowing from New York to London, and then the careful timing experiment of the signal coming from London back to New York, I would get slightly different timing. That's sort of the way magnetic fields work.
Yeah, but I was asking about something else. I was asking about, I was telling that you don't pay for the bending path of the electrons in plasma. Or particle acceleration, in terms of small particles, moves in plasma. But does it have to? Like the mechanical one, I'm talking about the concept. You don't pay for the bending of the path because it is being done using steady magnetic field, like you say in the air. So the ionosphere and the air space acts as the wave guide. But you're paying for the speed of the signal. You're paying for pushing it, but you don't pay for bending it. So ideally, you would be able to replace the magnetic one. I'm not saying about something that goes over unity.
Hold on now. If I decided to make the particles moving clockwise in the Large Hadron Collider, if I decided to stop accelerating them, I've got them up to 0.995 speed of light, and I stop adding the acceleration energy. I just continuously let them move in that vacuum at that one speed. And the magnetic field, I keep the magnetic field steady at that one rate. The magnetic field is continuously bending them, keeping them in the circle. It is not adding energy. It is not subtracting energy. The fixed velocity and the fixed magnetic field that's keeping them bending into a circle is not adding or subtracting energy.
Yeah, but you can add accelerating modules on the path. So that's what you didn't see, what I'd like you to see, 7 minutes of the mechanical process of the video would explain you all.
Okay. The modules that are giving a kick on each cycle are adding energy. You're paying for that. You are supplying the energy that's doing that kick. There is no free lunch.
Yeah, but the energy is extremely small. Maybe John would be able to explain you better.
When I'm pushing my daughter on the swing with my finger, I'm adding very little energy on each cycle. As long as I've got an efficient enough bearing at the top of the swing, and as long as there's no wind resistance, she will keep swinging at a larger and larger deflection. No matter how small my push is, if I keep doing it in the right timing, I will keep adding energy. No free lunch. Am I misunderstanding this? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
No, you're not, Dick. You're right. I'm not talking about the collider, and I cannot relate the collider to the mechanical system. I only have views on the mechanical system, Dick.
Okay, your interpretation of the mechanical system. On the first cycle, when the magnets come together and push something, it'll look like you're getting some energy. Can you do it over and over again without a external power supply, without an external amplifier? Can I do the mechanical thing over and over again, and whatever I'm accelerating keeps getting faster and faster? Is there free lunch here? I'm worried about that one. Over to you, John.
John, explain in a straight line first.
Yeah, the time is kind of short right now. But if when you get a chance, Dick, you look at that video, and then we can discuss it. I'm only talking about either making that into a circle or making it longer, because it does accelerate, because if you have eight magnets, as the first ball bearing taps that magnet and it produces a pretty violent reaction, it sends that bearing to the next toward the next magnet. The magnet sucks it up. When it hits that magnet, the ball on the other side of it is accelerated. So you get the idea of how two works. Now just imagine if I have eight or ten of these. That ball is moving pretty fast when it comes off the end.
I would say close to half or even more of the speed of the bullet from the pistol.
John, have you seen the experiment where somebody puts a tennis ball on top of a basketball? And he drops the combination down to the floor. The basketball bounces off the floor in almost a normal manner, but the tennis ball on top of the basketball really flies up in the air with a whole lot of extra energy. Have you ever seen that experiment, sir? John, go ahead.
Yes, I have.
Tell me where you think that extra energy is coming from.
Well, you have the small ball sitting on top of the large ball. As that large ball hits the floor and starts to collapse, it responds back. The ball on top is trying to penetrate that ball at the same time, and the big ball pushes it back up. So that's where all of that rebound is coming from, just the impact.
Yeah, the basketball would have ordinarily bounced a lot higher. Because it is cascaded with the tennis ball, some of the bounce of the basketball was lost, and because it was in phase, it got coupled to the tennis ball. And now, even though you dropped the combination from 5 feet, when they hit with this synchronous phenomenon, the tennis ball might fly 12 feet in the air, even though you dropped them from 5 feet. But you didn't get something for nothing. You can't do it over and over again and put more and more energy into that tennis ball. You can only do it once, so to speak. Are those magnets doing something similar to that, John? Go ahead.
Well, it seems to be a of the ball coming toward the magnet, gets drawn by the magnetic field, and it transposition the transposition of the energy.
Yes, you did, John. You got it through beautifully. And now, let me go one step further. I can start off with a very large beach ball. On top of that, I've got a tennis ball. On top of that, I've got beach ball, basketball, tennis ball, pong ball. If I carefully align them just right, I got those four balls, and I drop that combination. In theory, I could make that ping pong ball really fly out of there at an extremely fast rate and slam against the ceiling. And so now I've got four things cascaded, and it looks like I'm getting something for nothing. I'm pretty sure I'm not. I'm just carefully using this combination of large, smaller, 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 and so on, and the fact that all that bouncing takes place in phase. I can do it once, the whole combination, and in theory, I could probably put 10 different size balls together. And the smallest one on the top, if I carefully align them, I probably can make it come out of there at a speed so fast that it'll have trouble eating your eyes, and have trouble following it. but I can only do that once. Am I wrong? KC2WGB, K2RIW? Do you believe there's... Now, I think you can do this once. What makes any of us think that we can do this repetitively, John, without adding an external amplifier that's doing some kind of kick on each cycle, without doing that, how can this thing passively run in multiple cycles? Do you believe this passively can add energy on multiple cycles, and if I make a circle out of that, it'll keep going faster and faster without me adding energy? Is it a kind of perpetual motion? KC2WGB, K2RIW? Okay. With my having a 5 or 10 different size balls as a one-shot system, I can get a lot of energy one time. But if you look at what's required to get significant, relativistic velocities out of a particle accelerator, the number of kicks you're giving those particles in that Large Hadron Collider is many, many billions of kicks, maybe trillions and quadrillions of kicks required to get them up to the energy that where they're really doing the experiment. They literally are sucking a significant percentage of the energy out of the local town. They have to tell the town when they turn the LHC on so that the town can tool up and get ready for it, if you know what I mean. You're not getting a free lunch. Over to you, John, K2RIW. Okay. Once again, when you try to exceed conservation of energy, when you try to get something for nothing, if you can turn on and off a magnetic field, it looks like you're not adding energy to the process. Well, you can't turn off a steady-state magnet. You can't turn on a steady-state magnet without putting a lot of energy into the system that's doing the switching. You don't get it for nothing. There's a zillion so-called perpetual motion machines or above-unity machines to claim they can do that. A completely steady-state magnetic field can give you quite a bit of energy as one shot when you suck something into it. But you can't do that repetitively and keep getting more and more energy on each individual cycle. Lots of people think so. And lots and lots of YouTube videos show people doing it. But are they real? How come we're not all using those? Over to you, John, K2RIW. Yeah, I'll admit that a one-shot railgun or a one-shot a whole bunch of basketballs and tennis balls and ping pong balls and so on can give you a lot of apparent energy and what looks like gain, but it's not real gain. It's a very interesting cascade of impedance match. By the same token, I can start off with a 100-watt signal generator running at 50 ohms. I can put it into a kind of a filter. And by the way, filters don't have to have the same input impedance as output impedance. I can make a filter, which is a bandpass filter, at the same time that it's got a 50-ohm input and a 100-ohm output. I can take the 100-ohm output, put it into another filter that's got a 1,000-ohm output. Take the 1,000-ohm output, put it into another filter that's got 10,000-ohm output. Cascade those filters. And I can take your 100-watt signal that maybe was running at 100 volts, and I could make it into 1,000,000 volts at very little current. I can also build a step-up transformer where I've got very few turns in the primary and a whole lot of turns in the secondary. I can make a much higher voltage at a much lower current. I don't have more energy. I don't have more power. I can either make more voltage or I can make more current. Your Weller soldering gun makes a whole lot of current at very little voltage. Doesn't give you more energy. I can take one of those two things, which are current, and multiply it. I can't multiply both of them at the same time. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Okay, looking forward to it. From your point of view on what you've seen so far, any surprises, or is it pretty much doing what we sort of expected, John? Go ahead. Okay. I'll be taking a look at that. I think we've gone late enough, and hope we gave them their money's worth.